From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Patricia Hussey and Barbara Ferraro were two of the 24 nuns who signed a statement in the New York Times calling for the church to re-examine its stand on abortion. The Vatican pressured the nuns to recant, and all of them did except for Ferraro and Hussey. On today's Fresh Air, they tell us about opposing the Vatican and leaving the clergy. Also, British novelist David Lodge on satirizing the subject he knows best, life in academia. World music commentator Milo Miles tells us about one of the pioneers of Afropop, saxophonist and composer Manu Dibango. And Maxine Kuman reads a poem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. As the deadline for the automatic across-the-board budget cuts gets closer, budget negotiators are still meeting trying to come up with a budget deal, and politicians of both parties are busy blaming each other. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Bush began the barrage today. At a campaign stop in Akron, Ohio, he blamed the Democrats in Congress for holding up a budget deal. He said if the negotiators fail to meet the Monday deadline, the Democrats will be to blame for the $85 billion in across-the-board cuts that will result. The cuts will hurt. Health and safety inspections will be curtailed. Air traffic controllers and other government workers will be furloughed. Democrats defended themselves today, accusing President Bush of holding up a budget deal, with his insistence on a capital gains tax cut. Today, House Republicans said that the president might be willing to compromise on capital gains, and negotiators are now trying to work out a formula, some kind of preference for capital gains paired with some kind of an increase in taxes on the richest taxpayers, the ones who have the most to gain by a capital gains cut. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Secretary of State James Baker says Iraq has demanded a list of non-diplomats taking refuge in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad and has threatened to hang Americans found there. Baker was asked about a report that Iraq had sent the United States a note warning the U.S. Embassy in Iraq against giving shelter to non-diplomats and threatening such people with hangings. FBI Director William Sessions says the Bureau has been on alert for a possible Iraqi-linked extremist attack in the U.S. because of the Persian Gulf crisis. Sessions acknowledged at a news conference this afternoon that it may be difficult to prevent incidents involving Americans abroad. At least 8 more people have died in India in the disturbances over the government's plan to reserve more civil service jobs for those in low castes. The Prime Minister, V.P. Singh, had said he would rather resign than battle with aspirations of depraved people. The BBC's Peter Nettleship reports from Delhi.
In a strong appeal for dialogue and national unity, Mr. V.P. Singh said he had no intention of shirking his responsibilities. But he would not hesitate to resign if he had to choose between that and the cause he believed in so intensely. He said it would be easy, as many had urged him, to offer concessions or make compromises over the plan to increase vastly the number of government jobs in India reserved for the lower or backward castes. But, as he put it, I cannot barter away the aspirations of the deprived. Mr. Singh said he would continue discussions with all political parties, adding that he had appealed to the students 3 times to enter into a dialogue with the government, and 3 times he'd been turned down.
The BBC's Peter Nettleship in Delhi. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 26 points to 2459.65. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-1 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Barbara Ferraro and Patricia Hussey were both nuns when they decided the only way to keep their promises to God was to leave the clergy. Maybe you followed their stories back in 1984 when they were nicknamed the Abortion Nuns because they publicly opposed the Vatican's unequivocal opposition to abortion. But that wasn't their only difference with the church hierarchy. They said the abortion issue was just one example of how the Vatican had become authoritarian, expecting blind obedience without listening to either the clergy or laity. And Ferraro and Hussey could no longer accept women's subordinate role in the church. When they left the Sisters of Notre Dame 2 years ago, Hussey was 36 years old and had been a nun for 19 years. Ferraro was 42 and had been a nun for 24 years. They worked together at a shelter for the homeless in West Virginia. The two ex-nuns have written a book called No Turning Back. Their feud with the church over abortion dates back to 1984, when they signed a statement on Catholic pluralism and abortion that was published as an advertisement in the New York Times.
It was an ad that appeared in 1984, October 7th, that said there is a diversity of opinions among committed Catholics on the issue of abortion. And that was basically it. However, one of the lines that really got to the hierarchy was that there are more than one legitimate teachings within the Roman Catholic Church. And that appeared to be a very strong challenge to the hierarchy's position. And they have tried to present since that time that there is a clear and constant teaching on abortion in the Roman Catholic Church, which there is not.
Pat, you had mentioned that you had found in your research that there really was within the church's history a diversity of opinion on this. What views did you find through looking historically that challenged the church's current view?
Well, I think it's very interesting to go back in church's history. As we've said, there is not a clear and constant teaching. And often at the beginning and within the first few centuries, abortion was wrong if it covered marital infidelity. And therefore, the crime, so to speak, within the Roman Catholic Church was infidelity, was adultery. It was not the fact that there was abortion. In the Middle Ages, we are under the impression from many of the writings that occur that abortion was all right, especially in the life of the mother. What's interesting during the whole history of the Roman Catholic Church, of course, is the attitude towards women. And I believe it's Thomas Aquinas, and Barbara can correct me on this if I'm wrong, that said, the sperm, of course, holds all that makes a fetus a fetus. So the woman, of course, has nothing to do with it. But that also boys develop within 40 days, and perhaps women develop within 80 days. So there's always been rather a condescending view towards women throughout the history of the Roman Catholic Church. I think the astonishing thing to me is that in the 60s we were aware of that abortion was all right in the cases of life of the mother. But when we met with the Vatican officials in 1986, it was appalling for me to hear that abortion is wrong in all instances. And they told us, in fact, Archbishop Vincenzo Fagiolo at the time told us that women must repent of their sin of abortion. And we said, even in the cases of rape, incest, and life of the mother, and they said, absolutely, in all cases, it's wrong. And I think what's very clear is that through the centuries, as well as in this present time, women's experiences have never been taken into consideration as far as this issue goes.
How many other nuns signed the ad in the New York Times?
There was a total of 24 different nuns that signed the ad and four priests and religious men.
You were the only two nuns who didn't recant the statements. Was there pressure put on the other nuns who signed?
I think we all received the same kind of pressure from within our own communities to try to solve the situation so we could get on with life. I can't speak for the other signers. They all, in their own different way, either signed a statement, said what they needed to say, or settled with the Vatican and with their community in the way that they felt that they could. For us, we felt that we could not compromise from the very beginning. We would not compromise. We would not sign anything that would be misinterpreted by the Vatican as adherence to the Roman Catholic Church's teaching on abortion. The pressure for us escalated after 1986 when everyone else was cleared and we were the only two that were left. And the pressure came from within our own community as well as from the Vatican indirectly.
What kind of pressure did you get from within your community?
Why can't you just simply sign this, get on with life? They personalized us. They called us disobedient, disrespectful. We had no respect for life.
We have placed ourselves outside of the community. We didn't value our community membership. And I think it was very clear that they did that, Terry, because of fear and institutional survival. It was always, and I think as Barbara alluded to, it was always under the watchful eye of the Vatican, and we can never dismiss that. The Vatican was always Big Brother watching, and Cardinal Hammer made it very clear to the Sisters of Notre Dame that the Sisters of Notre Dame are under close observation because sisters cannot be pro-choice and remain nuns. What they tried to do then as the Sisters of Notre Dame was say, no, 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 the Vatican is not putting pressure on us. But when you have that direct a statement made publicly, of course you're aware that Big Brother was watching from the Vatican.
I think in any political struggle or any struggle that questions authority or questions a person's right, that the easiest way to dismiss it is to personalize it. And that's what happened to us. It became a very personalized issue within our community with the Vatican that we were just, why can't we just get on with life? Instead of looking at the broader issue that here were two common ordinary women who have had experiences with women who have had to choose to have an abortion or who have had to struggle with the question of birth control. And we were saying, you need to begin to listen to this experience. It's not us. It's out there. Many Catholics believe what we're believing. And it's so much easier to dismiss that and say, we have to have a united front by just personalizing and saying, oh, it's just Pat and Barbara and they're two disobedient nuns and they won't listen. And it's easier just to dismiss us that way rather than give credit to the argument.
My guests are Barbara Ferraro and Patricia Hussey, and they've co-authored a book called No Turning Back, Two Nuns Battle with the Vatican Over Women's Right to Choose. You met with two representatives of the Vatican in March of 1986 with Archbishop Vincenzo Fagiolo.
That's right.
And Sister Mary Lonscott.
Mm-hmm.
You felt that you were really being patronized as women by the
right.
Archbishop. What were the ways that you feel he patronized you?
Go ahead, Pat.
I think it was very interesting just to begin with, not even the Vatican officials, but the ambassador to the United States from the Vatican, Archbishop Pio Laghi. But he began with, I'm here and we are here to have a discussion, but I must insist after our time together that you must put in writing that you support and adhere to the Roman Catholic teaching on abortion. And as I introduced myself as Pat Hussey, I said, Archbishop, I find it interesting that we're here for a dialogue, but to use your words, you have said that we must put in writing that we support and adhere to the Roman Catholic teaching on abortion. That does not sound like a dialogue to me. So I think it started off under the guise of being there for a pastoral visit and not a juridical visit. As we went on, Archbishop Pio Laghi left the room because I think he felt he was escalating it. Archbishop Vincenzo Fagiolo sat by my side to my right and began to stroke my arm. And I think that it was trying to, as we have said before, trying to break us emotionally or appear to be pastoral, appear to be sympathetic, appear to be emotionally supportive of us, when in fact I think they tried to break us in a number of ways. He ended up stating that the teaching on abortion has been clear and constant since Mary was pregnant with the child Jesus, and we said that is not so, Archbishop. He tried to imply other things like, what would your mommies and daddies think if you were no longer nuns, and appeal that way. And of course, we said sets of our parents had been extremely supportive of us over the years.
I think another thing that happened during that meeting that we never realized till after we left and checked with the other nun signers, the Vatican officials met with 11 nun signers in 1986, and we were the last two. And after that point, we were still the only two then that did not sign something or compromise or clear ourselves. But one of the really critical things that happened at that meeting was that the Archbishop took out of his pockets coins with the head of the Pope on it, and he gave those coins as a blessing to each one of the people in the room except to Pat and myself. And what we found out afterwards was, and I figured we were just the peons, we weren't leadership people, that's why we didn't get them. But what we found out afterwards was that at the other Vatican meetings with the other nun signers, when the nun signers signed or got cleared, they then received their coins.
I see. Now, you write in your book that you didn't want to be secretly cleared. Had the church
right.
done that to other women?
Yes, they did. To one of the women that was mentioned in the book, Marge Tewitt, who was a very dear friend of ours, her superiors signed a statement or cleared her without her knowledge of knowing how that happened. Basically, she said to us, they lied, they lied, they lied. About 2 months after that happened, Margie died of stomach cancer. She told us not to sign anything, not to do anything, because it all will be interpreted as an adherence to the Roman Catholic Church's teaching on abortion.
I think it was real clear that the Sisters of Loretto had signed a very vague statement saying they respected human life, that the Roman Catholic hierarchy had a right to teach, and their statement ended up getting twisted and misinterpreted to the general public that they complied with the Vatican's adherence, or they adhered to the Roman Catholic teaching on abortion, which in fact was not part of their statement. So it was very clear that the Vatican would go to any length to try to give that appearance of compliance with their position.
What made you decide to leave as opposed to staying and trying to continue to be dissenting voices within the church?
I think it was first of all, we didn't leave the Roman Catholic Church. This sort of this indelible mark that we all receive when we become Catholics. And I think it's important that, you know, I am a Catholic for life and the church is stuck with me and I'm stuck with them. And so it's important that we stay with the church and that we don't go away so that we can keep prodding and keep raising the questions. We did leave the religious community we were members of back in 1988. And that was only after we received word from our community that they were not going to dismiss us. After a 2-year process of threats of dismissal in the actual process of dismissal, they took us right to the last step. We had said right from the beginning in 1984 we would not compromise our position. We would not leave voluntarily while we were under the threat of dismissal. So we knew we were in for the long haul. As soon as we got that letter, we were free for the first time in 4 years to say, all right, what do we do now? And what the community had said was, we will not dismiss you at this time. And what we realized were two things. One was that we were free to make that decision. We weren't under the threat of dismissal, that it was only going to be a matter of time if we continued to speak out and say what we believed on the issue of choice, that it would be only a matter of time before the process started again. And also, the struggle wasn't with other women. The struggle was with the men of the church, and therefore we did not want to continue the in-house fighting with our own sisters. The other thing is that we realized that in order to really stand in solidarity with all women, we needed to be lay women. We needed to renounce the security and the privileges that women have who are religious women.
Pat, in the book you write that it turned out that the only way to keep my promise to God was to stop being a nun. Do you feel that in some way you're still keeping your vows?
I think so. When I look back on my vow formula, it says that I will live a simple lifestyle, one that is chaste in love and for love of people, and one that is obedient to the spirit of justice as the acts of the Sisters of Notre Dame directed me. And that is still very critical. I hope that I can continue now and in the future to live my life about justice. And I think that the crunch came for me, Terry, when you began to realize that it was all right to deal with oppressive structures in society, that in fact Barbara and I had the blessing of our community to deal with the oppressiveness that occurred under Reagan's administration to those people that we work with, the homeless and the poor, and those are on welfare. But once we began to challenge the inequality, the injustices, the repression within the Roman Catholic Church, all of a sudden we were being forced to be silent, basically. We were not given the same freedom to discuss that. We were not given the same freedom to discuss publicly the inequality that exists in the church. And I think that that is why I chose to leave. In fact, my life has remained unchanged since 1988, before or after I've left. I continue to work at Covenant House in Charleston, which is an ecumenically sponsored group. And I hope to continue that for a long time to come.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guests are Barbara Ferraro and Patricia Hussey. They've written a book called No Turning Back, Two Nuns Battle with the Vatican Over Women's Right to Choose. This is Fresh Air. Barbara Ferraro and Patricia Hussey are my guests. They were two of the nuns who signed a New York Times ad in 1984 that called for a dialogue with the Catholic Church on the issue of abortion. Eventually, all the other co-signers recanted under pressure from the Vatican, but Ferraro and Hussey continued to question the Church's ban on abortion. They eventually resigned from the Sisters of Notre Dame in 1988. They've written a book on their battle with the Vatican called No Turning Back. Now, you're both still living in West Virginia and still both working at Covenant House.
Right.
But you're no longer nuns.
Right.
And, you know, a couple of years ago, for the first time in your adult lives, you are no longer nuns. And I'm interested in how your lives are different now.
Well, Terry, I don't think they're much different other than the fact that our commitment I feel our commitment is just as strong, if not stronger, and that we're free from the oppression, I think, that we both felt within our own community that was directed by the Vatican, that came and tried to silence us as nuns, that there's sort of a freedom about that, and also an uncertainty about where our lives will go, because being a member of a religious community, you did always have the security of knowing that your retirement, your old age, everything was taken care of, and we sort of gave that up. It's sort of like what women go through when they go through a divorce. I think we can identify some with that. I don't think our lives have changed at all. I think our commitment has become stronger.
I think what's interesting is I think some people thought that once we stopped being nuns that we would go out and become executives in some corporation. And of course, how real would our commitment have been previous to 1988 if in fact we chose to do other than what we did? I learned a great deal through the Sisters of Notre Dame. I would never undercut that whatsoever. I had a lot of experiences, a lot of education, international experience as a result of it, and that has meant something to me. I guess that's where it was the struggle that occurred, that when I had taken seriously the words of the Sisters of Notre Dame to challenge oppression that existed in church and society, and then did that, whether it was in U.S. the political sphere or in the church sphere, I expected that I would have the support of others behind me. But I think, as we said, there was a whole lot of fear operative and therefore wanting us to be quiet and maybe whisper what we were saying but not say it out loud.
Barbara, you started in the convent years before Vatican II.
Right.
Would you describe for us what it feels like to wear a habit and the veil?
Well, I entered in 1962 when Vatican II was just starting. So for about 5 years, I was in the habit. For me at that time, it was a very romantic kind of experience. I think very much like people going off to the Peace Corps, people taking on a romantic adventure at age 18. What did I know? I didn't know any differently. There was something wonderful about wearing the habit, that you were special, you were different. It's not until I looked back and realized what actually was done to me as a person, the depersonalization, the defeminization, the shaving of my head, the non-acceptance of myself as a person with emotions, with a body. It did have an effect on me, but at the time when I went through it, I felt, well, that's what I needed to do in order to be a good nun. And I had seen throughout my growing up in my childhood what nuns had done for my family, for my community, and how they made a difference in people's lives, and I wanted to do the same. So I figured I'd have to put up with this or deal with this during the time it took to become a nun. Fortunately, I was only in the habit, as I said, for 5 years, and it was a very confining kind of process, and I didn't realize that until we started shedding the habit, and all of a sudden, I was a person again. People would relate to me as a person, as a woman, as somebody that could touch their lives and speak to them, and the wonderful experiences I had when other women who were in the parish where I taught or worked would ask me my opinion or seek some counseling or help from me. That was a wonderful feeling because, once again, I was a human person, and that's what I was before I entered as a member of a family of 11 children. I was a person. I was an individual, and all of that was knocked out when I was in training and in my first years as a religious woman.
There's an image that really sticks with me of, after Vatican II, one of the nuns burning all the whips because they weren't going to be needed anymore. These were whips that were used for
Disciplines, as they called them, exactly. I was the one that walked in on Sister Patricia Agnes burning the whips down in the furnace room. And it's interesting how it has to be sterile. You know, they weren't called whips. They were called disciplines. And I think it was trying to make it probably more acceptable or cleaner, because a whip is a whip is a whip. And as you know, Barbara was one of the few, I believe, that did in fact chastise herself and whip herself when others had the good fortune or the good sense at the time of whipping their pillows.
But, you know, I'm thinking that for both of you, you went through incredible changes, starting off in the period just before Vatican II, and then seeing, you know, your clothes changed, you know, the whips are burned, you're allowed to be in the world.
mm-hmm. after Vatican II. Mm-hmm. And it must have given you this sense of relativism, the sense that whatever the church's teaching is or whatever is expected of a nun can change. Yeah.
That's what was wonderful about it, and I think what's wonderful about our story is that change did happen and that we were a part of that and that we took seriously what Vatican II asked us to do, to change, to look at our reality, look at the experiences of the world, redefine yourself as religious women. We took that seriously. We took seriously the teachings of the Sisters of Notre Dame, which were incredible teachings of social justice, standing with the oppressed. And then to come to find out, because we took those seriously, I for 26 years and Pat for 21 years, that we were punished because we did.
You both are part of a feminist religious group.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever go back to the Catholic Church anymore?
Yes, but it gets more and more difficult because the message oftentimes does not touch the experiences of women, and particularly of people who feel the oppression in the church. But yes, we're both members of what's called the Women Church Movement, which is a movement in the United States and also international, where women in the Roman Catholic Church, and now it's become an ecumenical movement, have said, we are church. We do not have to wait for the hierarchy to claim us as church. We do not need to wait to be ordained in the Roman Catholic Church because we are already church. And it's a way of coming together and reflecting and ritualizing our experiences as women and looking at how do we live that out day to day. Very unlike, I think, what people experience in the ritual of the liturgy every Sunday. It does not reach the people's experiences.
Where do you meet?
We meet in people's homes. In Charleston, we rotate around different women's homes and meet. And this is happening all over our country in different women's homes I guess buildings, if they can get room space at buildings, but basically in women's homes around this country.
I'm curious, do you think that because men within the church are celibate and unmarried and in a way very removed from the world of women and from families, that they are less understanding of women, women's rights, of women's sexuality, of the abortion issue?
I think that plays a big part of it. I find it interesting, though, too, that if you notice what's occurring in the Roman Catholic Church is that they are inviting dissident Episcopal married priests into the Roman Catholic Church and shoring up the hierarchy and the misogynist viewpoint. I think that it's a disgrace that they are allowing Episcopal married priests in when there are many Roman Catholic priests who have left and become married that would like to serve, and I think would like to break open the boundaries of the church out of the married state and come back, that they are being rejected in the favor of Episcopal married priests who don't believe in women's ordination, who don't believe in the changes that occur, who don't believe in dealing with sexism within their own church, and they are being welcomed into our Roman Catholic Church. I think that's a real slap in the face, not only against women, but the Roman Catholic priests who have left.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Barbara Ferraro and Patricia Hussey. Their new book is titled No Turning Back, Two Nuns Battle with the Vatican Over Women's Right to Choose. Next time, journalist Nicholas Pileggi, he wrote the screenplay for Martin Scorsese's new film Goodfellas. He collaborated on it with Scorsese. This story of life in the mafia was based on Pileggi's bestseller, Wise Guy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to a recording by one of the pioneers of Afropop, Mano de Bongo. He's the subject of today's review by world music commentator Milo Miles. David Lodge was already a writer when he decided to turn to teaching to pay the rent. The university job gave him a living and more. Academia was a subculture with its own rituals, jargon, and class structure. Coming up, David Lodge discusses his satires of academic life. And Maxine Kuhman reads a poem inspired by a Canadian pamphlet about how to protect yourself against bears in the woods. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. During a political fundraising swing through the Midwest today, President Bush blasted the Democratic leadership for failing to make more progress toward a budget agreement. If a budget package is not put together by Monday, the Graham-Rudman law will require automatic spending cuts. The president charged that the Democrats would be responsible for the havoc that ensues.
For air travelers, it means big cutbacks in air traffic control and substantial increases in flight delays and outright cancellations.
The president insisted that his demands for a cut in capital gains taxes are not holding up the process, but on Capitol Hill, Democratic Whip Bill Gray told reporters that capital gains and the president's concern for the rich are in fact the only stumbling blocks.
To force through such an unfair agreement, the president is willing to shut down government. He would rather lay off air traffic controllers, and drug agents, then ask the rich to help reduce the deficit.
Gray called on President Bush to return to Washington and get involved with the budget negotiations firsthand. Three Iraqi passenger planes touched down in Jordan today, but later Jordan said it would halt all flights to and from Iraq to comply with the UN embargo. The passengers aboard the regularly scheduled Iraqi Airways plane that landed in Amman included 9 expelled French diplomats and 11 Britons stranded during Iraq's invasion of Kuwait on August 2nd. The planes all returned to Baghdad. Earlier today, Jordanian officials said the passenger aircraft were not included in an embargo resolution passed Tuesday by the UN Security Council. A convoy of trucks has brought food and medicine from Jordan to Baghdad. It's unclear whether this cargo violates the international economic embargo. Terry Phillips reports from Baghdad.
Each of the 34 diesels was covered with pictures of Yasser Arafat, King Hussein of Jordan, and Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. On board was baby milk, biscuits, and medicine. That's according to the president of the Palestinian Charity in Jordan, which sponsored this trip. These trucks spent more than 8 hours crossing the desert today. The organizers say this delivery is not a violation of UN economic sanctions, since it consists solely of humanitarian goods. Earlier today, an Indian cargo ship arrived at the port of Qasr with 1,000 tons of food for the many refugees still trapped in Iraq and Kuwait. Distribution is to be supervised by the Indian Red Cross. That's a major policy change by the Iraqi government, which previously refused to allow it. For National Public Radio, I'm Terry Phillips in Baghdad.
The Pentagon says Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has ordered 40,000 troops out of Western Europe over the next year. The announcement is in anticipation of agreement on East-West forces reductions. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 24 points at 2461.63 in moderate trading of 151 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air.
In 1973, years before the current Afropop craze, the record Sol Makossa became an international hit, and Mano Dibango of Cameroon became the world's most famous Afropop performer. Even though the saxophonist and bandleader isn't as celebrated anymore, world music critic Milo Miles says he's still very active and full of surprises.
I don't know if he'd approve or not, but I always want to call him Uncle Dibango. I feel that affectionate toward the sax man with the shaved head and the mirror shades. While he's only 56, Manu Dibango is one of the true veterans of modern African pop. It took him a long time to work out the eclectic music that would put him in the spotlight, but when he did work it out, the whole world heard it. This was back in the dim mists of time, back in 1973, when it still seemed that everyone's pants were bigger at the bottom than at the top. Yes, the chant Michael Jackson stuck at the end of Wanna Be Startin' Something was taken from Sol Makossa. Dibango originally recorded Sol Makossa in 1971 as a kind of afterthought, an instrumental used to fill up the B-side of a single. A New York DJ named Frankie Crocker began playing it a couple of years later, and it took off like the proverbial shot. Sol Makossa remains the only African record by an African to reach the top 40. What's so special about it? Well, it has a concision, a sort of pop-tuned punch that many African dance numbers ignore, and the hook and the rhythm are wound together perfectly. But I've always thought the real secret was that Dibango had studied the big, honking tenor sax players on American soul records, particularly King Curtis. He could have called the number Cameroon Soul Stew. However, by the time he recorded Sol Makossa, Dibango was living in Paris, and his far-flung travels help explain the fascinating variety of his music. Dibango has played in a lot of different scenes. He was trained as a classical pianist in Paris, but he spent the last half of the 50s playing jazz in Europe. Then he returned to Africa and played with a major rumba band in Zaire. Then he returned to Europe, where he jammed with visiting American soul performers and led the house band on a French TV show. As you can tell, Dibango's a restless guy, always pushing something new into Afropop, always trying to stretch the boundaries of what he plays. His eager experimental attitude has been as much an inspiration to African performers as his music. He's a permanent avant-gardian. Until now, there's always been a good Dibango and a bad Dibango. The good Dibango charged through up-tempo jams and exploratory rhythm workouts. The bad dabango crept through sluggish reggae ditties and light jazz tunes with shallow improvisation so mellow that he seemed about to turn into Kenny G or something equally disastrous. Lo and behold, dabango has a new import album called Negropolitanes that gets back to his roots in 60s Afropop, and it's his best easygoing record ever. It features sensuous, flowing covers of Miriam Makeba, the eminent bandleader Dr. Nico, and this old favorite from Dabango's Zaire days, Joseph Kali's Independence Cha-Cha. Of course, Dabango properly considers himself one of the old masters, and the record includes a host of his sly originals. With the recent explosion of new, younger talents in Afropop, it would be easy to assume Manu Dabango is old hat, washed up. Negropolitans proves just how wrong that would be.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for The New York Times and The Village Voice. Manu Dabango's Negropolitans is on the Soul Paris label. This is Fresh Air. In David Lodge's new novel, a businessman confesses to a university professor that he loves her. The professor responds, "There's no such thing as love. It's a rhetorical device. It's a bourgeois fallacy. When I was younger, I allowed myself to be constructed by the discourse of romantic love." David Lodge's novels satirize the language of literary criticism and life in academia. He has an insider's knowledge of both. For 17 years, he taught English at the University of Birmingham in England, and is the author of several books of literary criticism in addition to 8 novels. His latest novel, Nice Work, is about an affair between a woman professor who knows nothing outside academic literary theory and a man in the industrial world who knows nothing about culture. I asked David Lodge why he brought these two characters together.
Well, I've written several novels before about the academic world, and some people, I think, seem to imply I could only write about the academic world, so there was a sense in which I wanted to prove I could write about something else. I was also living in the West Midlands, in Birmingham, in England, through a decade of considerable social and economic upheaval, I mean, broadly, the Thatcher years. And this had brought considerable disruption, both and recession, indeed, to local engineering industry, and also had imposed severe cuts on the universities of England, including the one I was working in at the time. And I really wanted to explore these subjects in a novel. Originally, I thought of it really being centred on the man and about his a kind of midlife crisis of a sort of industrial executive coinciding with some relationship with a woman from an intellectual background that he hadn't had any previous encounter with. And it was through doing the research to find out what kind of work such a man would do that I thought of the shadow scheme, and that was a way of bringing these two characters together.
Yeah, the shadow scheme is that it's the government designates the year industry year. So, you know, people from academia are being teamed up with people in the business world. So she, your woman character, is teamed up with this man who works in the corporate world. Was there any such scheme in real life, or did you just come up with this for a device for the novel?
Well, I actually invented it as a kind of cover for doing the research. I mean, I followed a friend around who is a managing director of an engineering company, and to explain my presence, we said that I was shadowing him as part of an industry year plan. It was industry year in 1986, so that made the story plausible. And shadow schemes are quite common, but there wasn't actually one between Birmingham University and local industry.
I would like you to read the paragraph in which you introduce Robin, and she's the character who teaches literature at the university. Her area of specialization is the industrial novel, and this is the paragraph in which she's introduced.
Right. The previous chapter ends with Vic Wilcox, the industrialist, at his desk in his factory in the morning, on a Monday morning in winter. And there, for the time being, let us leave Vic Wilcox while we travel back an hour or two in time, a few miles in space, to meet a very different character. A character who, rather awkwardly for me, doesn't herself believe in the concept of character. That is to say, a favourite phrase of her own, Robin Penrose, temporary lecturer in English literature at the University of Rummidge, holds that character is a bourgeois myth, an illusion created to reinforce the ideology of capitalism. As evidence for this assertion, she will point to the fact that the rise of the novel, the literary genre of character par excellence, in the 18th century, coincided with the rise of capitalism, that the triumph of the novel over all other literary genre in the 19th century coincided with the triumph of capitalism, and that the modernist and postmodernist deconstruction of the classic novel in the 20th century has coincided with the terminal crisis of capitalism.
Robin later goes on to say that the novelist is the capitalist of the imagination. Do you have colleagues at the university who speak like this about capitalism in the novel?
I speak like it myself with my other hat on,
yes.
Or have been known to, yes.
I was wondering if you think that that the language of structuralism has in a way really distanced academics from the rest of the world because nobody else understands it.
That's true, and it is ironic and perhaps tragic because, I mean, the subject matter of literary criticism is not just a professional subject matter, it's also something common to everybody. And there is a sort of paradox that the discourse about literature in the academy should be so impenetrable and so alien for people who enjoy books and enjoy literature, but can't understand the critical commentary upon it. That, I think, is regrettable.
You said that it's less common for British professors to also write popular novels than it is for American professors?
Well, I think it's probably rare for either, in either country, for professors to write popular novels. We don't have many creative writing programs in universities in Britain, so there are fewer writers on campus, and there are one or two like myself who, you know, profess English literature and write books of criticism and, as it were, write novels in their spare time.
How did you end up playing both roles, academic and novelist?
Well, it started out, I mean, I always wanted to be a writer, and the academic profession seemed a good one to combine with that. I never thought as a young man I could support myself as a freelance writer. So I went into the academic world for that reason. But I got interested in academic criticism and the activity of teaching in its own right. And for most of my adult life, I pursued these two careers in tandem and deliberately almost wrote a novel and a critical book alternately. And it was often rather refreshing to turn from one kind of work to another. But a few years ago, I began to get a little weary of the academic world and took the opportunity to leave it.
So you don't teach anymore?
Very little. I mean, I have an honorary title, so I'm still connected with the university and I give occasional lectures. I could teach more if I wanted to, but at the moment I don't want to.
Do you still like visiting universities a lot so you get a sense of what the drift is there?
Yes, I do, and I still get plenty of opportunities to do that. But I think that I doubt whether I'm going to write any more criticism which will be a contribution to the academic study of the subject, because once you leave the institution and its incentives and drives and compulsions, you no longer really feel like making the effort to keep up with the professional journals and so on the subject.
If you don't mind my asking, I know that you have a son who was born with Down syndrome.
Mm.
And I guess I'd be interested in hearing what it's been like for you as someone who lives very much in an intellectual world to have a son who's learning disabled.
Well, it was quite a shock at first. I mean, when he was born, it was not something my wife or I had ever thought about or considered to be something that might happen to us. And I won't disguise the fact that it was very painful and sad experience in many ways. But Christopher, the boy in question, fortunately he's physically very healthy. And really, he's brought a great deal of happiness to us, really, the way he's grown up and the amount of things he's been able to achieve. I suppose you could say it was a salutary sort of experience, in as much as being an intellectual, one does tend to value intelligence above all things. And Down's people are not terribly bright, but they are very lovable and loving. And they're also, on the whole, rather happy, at least Christopher is. I mean, he doesn't suffer from the kind of anxieties that most adults do. So it hasn't been, by any means, all a negative experience. It's been, in many ways, a very positive experience. But there is a kind of poignancy in the fact that one can see in him occasionally glimpses of a very brilliant person that he would have been, because for a Down's boy, his remarkable linguistic ability, really, and he takes a great interest in my work. It's slightly sad to think that it was just this extra stray chromosome that prevented him from perhaps, being a writer himself.
You say he takes an interest in your work and your novels?
Yeah,
he
does, yeah. I mean, he's much more enthusiastic about my writing than my two normal children. I think would prefer if I didn't write novels at all.
Do your other children read your books?
Yeah, inevitably, but they read them rather late in life, by mutual choice, I think.
Why didn't you want them to read them earlier?
Well, it's like the kind of taboos on discussions of sexuality in a family, I think. I mean, there's an element of private revelation or possible private revelation in any work of fiction. And there's also a sense in which you are or can be seen to be reflecting upon your own immediate relationships. And the sort of the delicate balance between fiction and reality is something I try and preserve, and I try not to write anything which would offend people. But I can see why my children might feel rather sensitive about reading what I write, and I feel the same. I mean, I never felt any desire to press the books upon them or discuss them in great detail with them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Writer David Lodge. His latest novel, Nice Work, has just been published in paperback by Penguin Books. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. President Bush is now said to be willing to back off somewhat on his call to cut the capital gains tax, and he blames the Democrats for the lack of progress toward a new budget. An announcement from Baghdad: Iraq is now threatening to deny food, promising almost to deny food to all foreigners Stranded in Iraq and Kuwait, beginning on the 1st of October. And Julian Crandall-Hollick reports from India on the problems of the untouchable caste and efforts to change their lot. Also, a civil war confrontation discussed between a real estate developer in Culpeper, Virginia, and some preservationists about the Brandy Station battlefield.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Earlier this month, the 1990 Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival brought together poets and poetry lovers from around the country for readings and workshops at Waterloo Village in New Jersey. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Maxine Kumin was one of the participants. Kumin lives on a farm in New Hampshire and takes much of her inspiration from nature. Here's a recording of Maxine Kumin reading one of her poems at the Dodge Festival.
I'd like to start tonight by reading a found poem, one that I really had very little to do with the writing of, although I did, the ending is mine. But almost all the language of this poem was found in a pamphlet published by the Canadian Minister of the Environment, and it's handed out in all of the provincial parks of the Canadian Northwest. The title of the pamphlet and the title of the poem are the same. It is, "You Are in Bear Country." They've been here for thousands of years. You're the visitor. Avoid encounters. Think ahead. Keep clear of berry patches, garbage dumps, carcasses. On woods walks, bring noisemakers, bells, clap hands along the trail or sing. But in dense bush or by running water, bear may not hear your clatter. Whatever else, don't whistle. Whistling is thought by some to imitate the sounds bears make when they mate. You need to know there are two kinds, Ursus arctus horribilis, or grizzly, and Ursus americanus, the smaller black, said to be somewhat less likely to attack. Alas, a small horribilis is difficult to distinguish from a large americanus. Although there is no guaranteed life-saving way to deal with an aggressive bear, some ploys have proved more successful than others. Running's a poor choice. Bear can outrun a racehorse. Once you're face-to-face, speak softly. Take off your pack and set it down to distract the grizzly. Meanwhile, back slowly toward a large, sparsely branched tree. But remember, black bears are agile climbers, in which case a tree may not offer escape. As a last resort, you can play dead. Drop to the ground face down. In this case, wearing your pack may shield your body from attack. Courage, lie still. Sometimes your bear may veer away. If not, bears have been known to inflict only minor injuries upon the prone. Is death by bear to be preferred to death by bomb? Under these extenuating circumstances, your mind may make absurd leaps. The answer's yes. Come on in. Cherish your wilderness.
Maxine Kumin reading earlier this month at the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival. Her latest collection of poems, Nurture, is published by Viking. Special thanks to Allison Dufty. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Mafia and Movies, with journalist Nicholas Pileggi. His bestseller, Wise Guy, was adapted into the film Goodfellas. Pileggi co-authored the screenplay with the director, Martin Scorsese. Also, journalist James Conaway on the history and future of America's top wine region, the Napa Valley. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.